From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn where abortion access litigation stands with the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Then we'll learn about an effort to list the monarch butterfly as a threatened species.
You know, many folks can remember times where they would see more monarchs on the landscape than they do now. So it's hard news just knowing that a species like the monarch has declined so much.
Plus, we'll trace the geological history of Milwaukee's City Hall.
This rock is the oldest rock that at least I've identified from City Hall. And it dates to a period called the Ordovician period. And it's about 450 million years old.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Abortion is still in the courts in Wisconsin after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022. Also in the courts, whether public employees can unionize or whether 2010's Act 10 still stands. WUWM's Mayan Silver is exploring these big cases the state Supreme Court is tackling. Today, we'll learn more about what's happening with abortion rights with Brina Gadar, staff attorney at the State Democracy Research Initiative at UW Law School.
Oral arguments on a case that could decide whether abortion is legal in Wisconsin happened last month. Democratic Attorney General Josh Call argues that a 175-year-old law that conservatives say ban abortions in Wisconsin doesn't apply because of another law on the books in 1985. He also says it's a feticide law, which means that it would only outlaw causing the death of a fetus without the mother's consent and doesn't ban consensual abortions. So that was a mouthful. Sorry about that. How significant is this case, and what did you take away from the oral arguments? Did you pay attention to those?
Yes. So this case really is going to determine what the law on abortion currently is in Wisconsin. And so a circuit court, a lower court in Wisconsin, had already concluded that this so-called 1800s abortion ban only applied to feticide and not to consensual abortions. So we have had sort of that rule on the books now for a while that this isn't applied to ban all consensual abortions, but this is going to be sort of the really final determination on that from the Wisconsin Supreme Court.
Before Roe v. Wade was overturned, there was that law from 1985 which allowed abortion up to 20 weeks, right, in Wisconsin?
Mm-hmm.
And then after Dobbs, which overturned Roe v. Wade, then Wisconsin's law kind of jumped back to an arguable, questionable situation on where abortion stood. And so there was a ban for a while under the 1849 law, right?
Yes. So, yeah, exactly. So after Roe was repealed, there was this question of whether that 1849 statute did ban consensual abortions. And providers, because of that uncertainty, stopped providing abortions in the state for a while there. And then a lower Wisconsin court that addressed the issue concluded that that statute didn't apply to consensual abortions. But now that has been appealed, and so we need to have sort of final resolution on that issue from the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And the biggest issues, you know, that came up in oral argument were sort of how the court should approach interpreting that 1849 statute. You know, should it interpret it as only banning feticide, or should it interpret it as having been repealed by these later laws that essentially said abortion was legal up to a certain point, because those later laws conflict with what would be read as sort of an all-out abortion ban. So there's sort of this debate about how the court should interpret the statute, and that will sort of set the groundwork for what abortion law currently is in the state. But then there's this other case that's happening as well that's kind of on pause that deals with whether under the Wisconsin Constitution there is also a right to abortion and whether that is protected under the Wisconsin Constitution.
And do you think that petition, which is from Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin, there's the one case by Democratic Attorney General Josh Call, and there's the other case from Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin, which is arguing that There's a right to an abortion implied in the Wisconsin Constitution under the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. In oral arguments, I think the justices had some questions for the attorneys about this topic. Other professors had predicted that the court would merge these two cases. What's the latest on that?
So the court agreed to take up the constitutional case, but then hasn't actually scheduled briefing or oral argument in that case. So it's not clear exactly what their plan is for it, but it might kind of hinge on how they decide the statutory case, because the plaintiffs in the constitutional case brought their claims in large part premised on if there was a ban. So they kind of framed the claims as, if this is read as a ban on abortion, then that would violate the Wisconsin Constitution. And so it's not clear what will happen if the Wisconsin Supreme Court rules that that 1849 statute is not actually a ban, then it might not actually address those constitutional issues just yet.
So for people that don't understand, you know, maybe what the nuances between statutory decision and the constitutional question
yes.
would be, could you just sort of lay that out sort of briefly?
Yeah. So generally, when a court is deciding a case, they try not to issue things that are called advisory opinions, and they try to actually just address issues that are live controversies. So there's some actual conflict happening, or there's some actual law that's violating the Constitution or something like that. And so the way that the petitioners in the Planned Parenthood case have framed their argument is that if that 1849 statute is read to be a ban on consensual abortions, then that statute violates the state constitution. And so if the court decides in this other statutory case that that 1849 statute is not understood as a ban on consensual abortions,
that it is instead a feticide law that would deal with just if someone attacks a pregnant woman, right?
Correct. So if the Wisconsin Supreme Court takes that direction and goes with that interpretation, then it's not clear that that other case would have any live issue to be decided, because there then wouldn't be a ban on abortion, and so there wouldn't be anything that they would be challenging in that lawsuit. And so the court typically wouldn't take on the role of just independently deciding whether there is a right to abortion under the Constitution without there being some specific law that is being challenged. And that's not to say that a different claim couldn't be brought that does that, but it's not clear with this specific case how it was brought, if it would go forward or not.
If that happens, that they decide that the law doesn't actually ban abortion and they can't go forward with deciding on whether abortion is protected under the Constitution, if that happens, how could the plaintiffs bring that constitutional question before the court?
So there are other restrictions in Wisconsin on abortion, and you could conceivably have a plaintiff bringing a challenge against one of those, similarly arguing that it violates the state constitution.
This is WUWM's Mayan Silver speaking with Brenna Gadar of UW Law School. So stepping back for a minute, what would be the next steps if the state Supreme Court, which currently has a liberal majority, would rule that the 1849 law doesn't apply to abortions?
If the court rules that that law does not apply to abortions, then we will have just sort of the same abortion framework that we have had up until now and have had in recent years.
Okay. And do you anticipate or have any hunches as to whether the court would decide that or issue a decision before the April election? Of course, there's a seat opening on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Justice Ann Walsh Bradley is retiring. So do you think that the court will issue a decision before April's election, a decision on the abortion case?
It's hard to say for sure, but I think it's certainly possible that they could issue a decision before then. Oral argument took place last month, and so it would be a reasonable amount of time for them to write an opinion, but it's just hard to say if that will happen before or after the election.
What do you think the political implications would be either way of issuing a decision?
So I think whether or not the court issues a decision in the statutory case before April. I think it's pretty unlikely that they will issue a ruling on a constitutional right to abortion. And so I think abortion is going to continue to be a pretty major issue for folks headed into the April Supreme Court election.
So do you think it's strategic not to issue a ruling on the constitutional question before the election?
I don't want to guess at any motives, but I think the bigger issue with the timing of the statutory and constitutional questions is that, like I mentioned, the constitutional case is somewhat premised on how the statutory case comes out. And so it does make sense to sequence them like they are from a legal standpoint of addressing that statutory question first, because that will affect how the court goes about or if the court even addresses those constitutional claims in the other case.
So we've got this case going, and it's going to essentially decide at some point, you would imagine, in 2025, what the law is on abortion in Wisconsin. What's happening at the federal level? We've got a new Trump administration coming in January and a GOP-led Congress. What are you hearing about how that could impact abortion law in the country and specifically abortion law in Wisconsin?
So I think the big thing that we've seen post-Roe, so after Roe v. Wade being overturned, is that this issue has been punted to the states to decide. And so really, the state legislature and the state Supreme Court and the governor are the ones who are largely deciding what abortion law looks like in Wisconsin right now. And it's possible that that will continue, that states will continue to be the primary place where this policy decision is getting made. But if the federal government decides to step in, then federal law would ultimately preempt state law and would set the bounds of when abortions can or cannot be performed.
Do you think abortion is as mobilizing of an issue for the Wisconsin electorate as it was in the 2023 state Supreme Court race? Do you have any sense of that? That was a race between now Justice Janet Protasiewicz and conservative-backed former Justice Daniel Kelly.
Yeah, I think it depends a little bit on what happens in the next few months. I think potentially a ruling in this statutory case about abortion in the state could make it sort of less of a live issue. In 2023, you know, the court had not yet addressed abortion at all. But I also don't know that that's the case, because there is still this constitutional question out there of whether the Wisconsin Constitution protects a right to abortion or not. And it is pretty unlikely that that will get resolved before April. So I think it still might be a pretty salient issue. I think the other factor that could come into play is, like you mentioned, if the federal government gets involved in this in some way and takes these decisions out of states' hands, that could also lessen how prominent of an issue this is headed into April. But I think overall, I think it will still be one of the top issues that voters are thinking about.
Gotcha. Okay. And then when it comes to the candidates, I mean, we don't know completely all the candidates that will be running.
January 1st is the filing deadline.
Okay. Gotcha. So we don't completely know who everyone's going to be, but we've got some main candidates. Waukesha County Judge Brad Schimmel, who's backed by the GOP, and Dane County Circuit Court Judge Susan Crawford, who's backed by Democrats. What do you think? Is there anything that you think listeners should know about those candidates when it comes to this issue?
I think, you know, we'll see a lot more of them in the coming months, so have more opportunity to learn about the candidates for sure. But I think their previous records are interesting in that they both have prior records on this issue. So Judge Crawford, when she was an attorney, she represented Planned Parenthood in a case to expand Wisconsin abortion access. And Judge Schimmel, when he was attorney general, he was on sort of the opposite side of things and supported more restrictions on abortion. And so given sort of that they both have these public lives prior to becoming judges, we have a little bit of their records to go on in thinking about how they might approach these issues.
All right. Well, thank you, Brenna Goddar of UW Law School, for speaking with me about the court.
Thank you.
Brenna Goddard is a staff attorney at the State Democracy Research Initiative at UW Law School. She spoke with WUWM's Mayan Silver. Tomorrow we'll bring you more of their conversation about Act 10 litigation. Monarch butterflies could soon be listed as a threatened species. The population has dropped dramatically since the 1980s, and there's been an effort to get them listed since 2020. Last week, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service set things in motion to get the monarch listed. The service is encouraging the public to help with the monarch's recovery by commenting on its proposed listing as threatened. Wisconsin is among the places monarchs spend time along their migratory journey. One of the groups rooting for the butterfly is the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin. Caitlin Williamson is Director of Conservation, and she joins WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Bentz.
At the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin, we protect Wisconsin's lands, waters, and wildlife, and we do that by providing funding. So we've provided lots of grant funding over the years to support monarchs and other pollinator conservation efforts. We also do that by building partnerships. A great example of that is helping, together with our partners, establish the Wisconsin Monarch Collaborative, which is really the first of its kind statewide consortium of organizations who have come together to support the monarch. We also do a lot of connecting people to nature. So we've got this fabulous field trip program where folks, adults, families, people of all ages can get out with different conservation experts and connect with nature directly. So we've got some amazing, for example, monarch tagging trips every year with our partners.
Tell me a bit more about this collaborative. It came together in 2017, is that right?
It did. You know, there had been a lot of conversation within the conservation space about the decline of monarchs that had been observed. And at that time, there were a lot of other states who were looking to build kind of statewide efforts and develop statewide plans for monarch conservation. So the Monarch Collaborative was established. We had an initial Wisconsin Monarch Summit back then to kind of determine how all these different groups in the state wanted to come together and work together collaboratively towards monarch conservation efforts, and the WMC grew out of that. Fast forward to today, and we have more than 50 different partner organizations who are represented in the collaborative, statewide agencies, the Department of Natural Resources, DATCAP, the Department of Transportation, as well as local government groups, to nonprofit organizations, utility companies, farm and agricultural groups who are really working together. We've got various working groups such as energy and transportation, agriculture, urban and green space, really looking at how can we, of course, support monarchs by putting in more native milkweed and wildflowers, because both of those are important for monarchs throughout their life cycle.
The impetus originally was that is around the time that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service there were rumblings that the monarch might be designated as threatened or endangered?
That's right. There were preliminary conversation about that and efforts also at kind of regional and national levels of, right, how are we taking care of the species that we have seen these declines by about 80% just within recent decades. And so, you know, at that time, there was an effort within the Midwest Fish and Wildlife Association group to really look at kind of a regional Midwestern plan for monarch conservation. And Wisconsin really factors into that because much of the state is within the eastern core of the population that we see kind of east of the Rocky Mountains in the United States. It's really important breeding grounds for monarchs. We see multiple generations of monarchs that breed in Wisconsin before heading south to Mexico, where they overwinter. So really a key place for conservation of the monarch butterfly to happen is right here in Wisconsin.
Does Wisconsin have a plan for, I shouldn't say of attack, but of attack?
Yes, we do have a plan. That's one of the deliverables that the Wisconsin Monarch Collaborative worked on together, was establishing the first Wisconsin Monarch Conservation Strategy to exist. So that came out a few years ago. And what's really important about that is it specified a milkweed stem goal. So the goal in there is to put 119 million new stems of milkweed on the landscape by 2038. So it's kind of a long-term goal, which is a lot, right? And that really speaks to the kind of all hands on deck approach that is needed for monarchs. So meaning we need, you know, not just habitat in our public lands across state parks and natural areas and wildlife areas, but also, you know, in medians, in cities or in county highways, in people's backyards. Every stem counts. That's the, of course, the host plant for the monarch butterfly. And it's not like we want to see just milkweed, right? But within a kind of a matrix of native wildflowers, which the adults nectar on. And obviously that benefits so many other species too, other pollinators and invertebrates, birds, really, really great habitat for a wide array of species. And so that plan specifies some of the kind of goals that different working groups within the collaborative are working towards. So I'd mentioned the protected lands group or the agriculture group. There's also a research and monitoring working group within the collaborative that helps really ensure that you know, the best available science is informing the conservation efforts, as well as communications and outreach. And that's been a really great facet of the collaborative, is the information sharing with the public. Lots of our team, and I should say the Monarch Collaborative is primarily volunteer led. We have one coordinator for the collaborative, but it's a lot of people who are volunteering their time to support this work and getting the word out through outreach, whether that's at conferences or presentations or tabling at different events like Butterfly Action Day at Olbrich Gardens, a lot of places like that.
What are your initial thoughts when the news did come through that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is indeed moving in the direction of naming the monarch butterfly as threatened?
Yeah. Well, you know, my initial reaction is it's great news to have those protections for monarchs. That's going to make a really big difference if that goes through with monarchs and pollinators. And at the same time, it really affected me just seeing, you know, the scientific data, the species assessment reports that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service did for monarchs, right? It, of course, this has been known for a long time within the conservation community that we've been seeing those declines, but just really seeing this affirmed by the service, their estimation for the extinction probability for monarchs by 2080 is 56 to 74%, and right, that just really hit me hard. It's a species that we all have grown up seeing, and they're around and iconic, and once were common. I'm sure, you know, many folks can remember times where they would see more monarchs on the landscape than they do now. So it's hard news just knowing that a species like the monarch has declined so much. And it's really a really great opportunity to have these protections in place, but also a call to action that I hope will inspire so many different people. And that's to me, what's really beautiful about monarch butterflies and their conservation efforts is that literally everyone can make a difference. Even students within a school, we've had students do like a penny fundraiser for our pollinator fund and put in pollinator plantings in their schoolyards. If you live in, you know, in a city, putting in milkweed and other native plants in your own backyard, all the way to, you know, large corporate campuses. And anyway, the point being that there's so much that everyone can do to help make a difference. And I think that's really inspiring.
There's a 90-day comment period that has been initiated now with the Fish and Wildlife Service announcement, right? What's important about those 90 days or these 90 days?
Yes. So the proposed listing is just that. It's proposed. It's not finalized. So there's currently no legal protections in place for the monarch. Right now, that public comment period is open. So it's an opportunity for the public to act, to really share their perspective on what they think about the proposed listing decision.
So some of the influences that are impacting many, many species, including the monarch, is loss of habitat, right?
Mm-hmm.
Climate change is a profound influence on all this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in Wisconsin and other states that would be part of this migration path would be agriculture. I mean, Wisconsin is an agricultural state. So is that one of the key elements, is how we farm?
Yeah, definitely. Working with Wisconsin's farmers is going to be huge for the success of this. And they, you know, there's so many champions among them already. For example, Awesome Farms is a producer that we've worked with at the Natural Resources Foundation through our Wisconsin Pollinator Protection Fund. They're part of the Wisconsin Healthy Grown Potatoes Program, which is a really innovative, holistic approach at caring for the land. Some examples are Pheasants Forever and Sand County Foundation. Some of our partners have really been working closely with producers. There's even a Farmers for Monarchs initiative across the country. There's just lots of opportunity for producers, and it's really great to see some of the involvement we've had so far within the Wisconsin Monarch Collaborative, within the agricultural space. And certainly there's a long ways to go, but I think it's really exciting that the role that farmers can play and producers can play in helping this, because it's totally a team effort.
Anything you want to underscore?
It's big news that this listing proposal has happened, and I'm incredibly hopeful that Wisconsinites will step up from all facets of our state, you know, different sectors, to really contribute and make a difference together within communities. And there's a lot of ways that people can help. So I've mentioned, of course, doing what you can to put in milkweed and native plants within your own areas of influence, whether that's your backyard or, you know, schools or community centers or places of worship or where you work, everywhere it's needed. I would also say, too, for the Wisconsin Monarch Collaborative, the statewide consortium, we're especially now seeking more members from organizations, you know, so if you're a representative from local government or corporations who care about this, farmer groups or producers or urban organizations, we need you and would love you to be part of the collaborative. So it would be great to have folks reach out to me or to the Wisconsin Monarch Collaborative to find out more. And also just for the public, we have an email newsletter that folks can sign up for on the website, wimonarchs.org. And just a plug, too, that we're looking for donations to get good monarch habitat on the ground and to support the coordination of this big statewide effort now more than ever, right, with this listing decision. But I think my biggest hope would be that people, you know, really take this to heart and know that they can make a difference. It's a really incredible opportunity.
Caitlin Williamson is Director of Conservation with the Natural Resource Foundation of Wisconsin. She spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz. The public comment period is open until March. You can find tips on how to protect monarchs at WUWM.com. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Coming up next, we'll learn what Milwaukee City Hall is made of. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. When it was constructed in 1895, Milwaukee's City Hall was the third tallest building in the country, and it remains one of the oldest continuously used city halls. But its story begins over 400 million years ago, when its building materials began to form. Raymond Wiggers is a geologist and author of Milwaukee in Stone and Clay. He joins Lake Effect's Sam Woods to discuss the architectural geology of City Hall for the latest episode of What Milwaukee is Made Of.
Ray, to start, what is City Hall made of?
The short answer is it's made of practically everything you can imagine. It is a wonderful farrago of different materials brought in from various places in the United States.
Well, let's start with a few of the exterior materials, starting with Berea sandstone, one of the oldest of City Hall's exterior building materials. Where and when did Berea sandstone form?
Before I answer that directly, let me just point out to the listeners, the Berea sandstone is found down near the bottom of the building. So, for example, if you come in to City Hall through the southern entrance where they have those beautiful, huge semicircular arches, that's where the sandstone is located. And in terms of its geologic age, it dates to the Mississippian subperiod of the Carboniferous period, which is a real mouth twister. But what that is, it means it's about, 350 million years old. It's actually a very well-known building stone that comes from close to the Lake Erie shore of northern Ohio. So just a little bit to the west of Cleveland, Ohio. And it's right near the lake shore. And it's quarried in several different towns along the Erie shore there. And it started at a very different time when North America, including Ohio and including Wisconsin, were located south of the equator or just on it. In fact, by the Mississippian, we were very, very close. The Midwest was very close to the equator. And furthermore, we were locked into a larger supercontinent, which everyone knows, Pangaea. At that point, there was actually an inland sea that covered a good portion of the Midwest. And there was a river coming down on dry land from the north that actually flowed into that inland sea in Ohio. And right where Cleveland, that Cleveland area is now, there was a large river delta. And that sand actually was deposited in channels in that particular, in fact, they were almost like canyons that were in that delta and formed a lot of sand deposits, which now are considered very high quality building stone.
And so about 40 million years after this river in what is now Ohio, but at that time was in Pangaea and around the equator, about 40 million years after this, St. Louis brick and Winkel terracotta came onto the scene. How were these formed?
Right. Well, what came onto the scene, Sam, was the clay that would form the brick and the terracotta eventually. So what we had at that point, now this is the next subperiod in the Carboniferous. This is the Pennsylvanian. And during the Pennsylvanian, Pangaea, or at least our part of Pangaea, was covered by a huge swampland with these very primitive large trees growing. These were the coal swamps of the Carboniferous period. And the material that made the St. Louis clay that's up higher on the building and the Winkel terracotta, which was the trim that was used to sort of ornament the brick, those both come from clay deposits of various kinds that were deposited in the Pennsylvania in this coal swamp environment.
So as you mentioned, all three of these building materials at least began their lives 300 million years ago or more. But did these materials look the same in nature millennia ago as they do on City Hall today?
That's a good question, and it makes me think for a minute, because the Berea sandstone was probably its current buff or light tan color going back to pretty close to its origin, if not its origin itself. That sand was probably that color from the beginning, and then it solidified into sandstone. As far as the brick and the terracotta, those colors have changed tremendously, because what do you do to make brick? Well, you take this clay, whether it comes from a coal swamp environment or somewhere else from some local clay pit, and you put it in a kiln and you burn it at thousands of degrees temperature, and that will often change the color very dramatically. And St. Louis was actually one of the great brick making centers of the world back in the late 1800s. And early 1900s, and they had different formulations, things they would put into the clay that would actually make the color actually different colors depending on what the customer wanted. And this particular formulation was ordered by the architect of City Hall to have that particular color we see today, but it probably started as kind of a grayish clay. As far as the terracotta goes, it was fired, and when that clay was fired in the kiln, it turned into kind of a pale orange color called, it's a material called bisque. And then it was later covered with a glaze to whatever color the customer wanted.
So it's interesting that the building materials for Milwaukee City Hall came from other places. You mentioned St. Louis, Ohio. Why were these materials chosen over something that's more locally sourced, like Cream City Brick?
That's interesting, isn't it? And I can't really say, I mean, I don't know what the exact decisions were, why a particular material was chosen. For example, St. Louis brick was chosen over Cream City brick, which came in very high quality forms too. Except that I think the architect and the designers in general probably thought that they had a particular color they wanted or particular color scheme they wanted, a combination of colors that were not provided by local materials. And so they went with other stone. Also, sometimes it was just a matter of economics for some of these, even high quality building projects like City Hall. Sometimes there was one particular type of stone that was available from dealers, local dealers, at a lower price. And so the architect would say, yeah, let's just go with that instead. So it could have been any of those factors.
That reminds me of our previous episode on Cream City Brick, how, you know, at one point it was seen as this highly in-demand brick, both locally and then, you know, across the nation. But then eventually economics just kind of turned against it, and fashion went against it, and it's just times changed. But I'm curious, do you know, kind of flipping that question around, do you know of any city halls in other states that use Cream City brick or other materials that would be sourced locally here?
I've researched a number of different city halls in different cities in America and also in Europe, and I don't know of any that used Cream City brick specifically. I do know of many buildings from New York City to Minneapolis and beyond that use Cream City brick. And there are some very well-known residences in other places besides Milwaukee and churches. There's a very famous old church in Chicago, which actually survived the Chicago fire in 1871, Old St. Pat's, that is made of Cream City brick. So there are a number of buildings, but city halls, no, I don't think so.
Well, keeping on the exterior for one more question, and then we'll move to the interior materials. When City Hall was completed in 1895, it was the tallest building in the city. Now, I'm no expert on construction, but I do know that what is now Milwaukee's east side was, at least at one point, a marshy wetland. How was City Hall anchored into this squishy environment?
Well, you know, you've just touched upon one of the most fascinating parts of architectural geology in general is how do these buildings, especially big, heavy buildings, stand up in material that is often very, very, well, it's not at all ideal for foundations. And Milwaukee architects used one particular method for this and other large buildings. There were other methods as well, but the main one they used was to drive in a huge number of wooden piles. Now, a pile is basically just a trimmed tree trunk, usually a red pine or some other conifer tree trunk. They drive a huge number of these on the site before the building was constructed, and then they would put this stable basement on top of that. And with Milwaukee City Hall, that system worked beautifully for up until recent times. But starting in the middle of the 20th century, and as time went on even more, it became apparent that those wooden piles were not holding up as well as people had thought. If you keep them submerged in groundwater, in water underground, they won't rot very much. But sometimes the water table in Milwaukee would go up and down or whatever, and these big logs or these big piles were actually rotting. And so what had to be done to save the building and keep it stable and keep it upright was to build a reinforcement system of what are called micro piles. These are steel tubes that were driven in around the original piles. So as the original piles rot away, these metal supports will actually take up the load completely.
So moving to the interior of City Hall, your book, Milwaukee in Stone and Clay, highlights Holston limestone, otherwise known as Tennessee marble. So what was this material's origin story? When and where was it formed?
Yeah. So if you go inside the wonderful interior of this best city hall on the entire planet. One of the different stone types you'll see, and there are several, and there's also some other materials that look like stone that haven't really been identified or recorded. But one thing that was recorded was this thing called Holston limestone, and you find it in the wainscoting and the panels along the sides of the main rotunda chamber. And this rock is the oldest rock that at least I've identified from City Hall. And it dates to a period called the Ordovician period. And it's about 450 million years old, which makes it almost half a billion years old.
And where was this material sourced and why was it chosen for City Hall?
Well, a good way of answering that is to use its trade name. It wasn't known as Holston limestone to the people who built City Hall. It was known as Tennessee marble because even though it was a non-metamorphosed limestone, it had the properties of being polished very nicely and being nice and hard. So it was very much like a marble. And it actually comes from what is now eastern Tennessee in some of the areas that were hit so badly recently by our Hurricane Helene. It comes from a time when that part of North America that's now dry land, in fact, it's on the western side of the Appalachian Mountains, when it was actually continental shelf off the edge of what is now North America. And eventually what happened, another landmass came up and collided with that side of the continent and scrunched this material up and made it part of the margin of North America at the time.
So your book mentions that the interior of City Hall reminds you of M.C. Escher prints, those prints that are like stairways going up forever, kind of optical illusions. Do we know anything about the architect's intentions for the interior of City Hall? And specifically, did they mean to have this kind of optical illusion effect, or is that just how it ended up?
I wasn't able to determine whether or not it was a conscious effect that Henry Cook was driving for. I think part of the reason it looks that way is that the building had to be positioned on a narrow wedge-shaped, sort of narrow triangular lot. And if you wanted to have any kind of really grand rotunda, you know, where you had this light well in the middle, you know, with light pouring down in the middle of the interior, you may have had to do that. But I think his brilliant design of cast iron railings and different levels and everything, he did such a magnificent job. It has that optical illusion appearance to it. And you can really get vertigo if you lean up or if you tilt back and you look up at it for too long. It's very easy to get vertigo.
Well, Ray, thank you so much again for joining us on Lake Effect. I, as always, appreciate your time.
It's been a delight talking about the most wonderful city hall on the planet. Thanks, Sam.
That was Raymond Wiggers, author of Milwaukee in Stone and Clay, a book about the architectural geology of Milwaukee buildings. He spoke with Lake Effect's Sam Woods. A new season of Bubbler Talk is underway, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. We'll learn about some of the secrets of the Milwaukee Art Museum from a curator. Next on Lake Effect, on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The Milwaukee Art Museum is undoubtedly a symbol of the city. Liz Siegel is approaching her 2-year anniversary as the chief curator of the museum after working for many years at the Art Institute of Chicago. As chief curator, she leads the museum's curation of new exhibits, what it shares from its permanent collection, and works to engage the community through its art. Siegel and I spoke on her 5th day on the job, back in January of 2023. What drew you to the Milwaukee Art Museum?
Well, I had been at the Art Institute for 25 years, and I actually wasn't really looking for a new job. And I saw this opening, and I just thought, this is actually really compelling. It's a gorgeous building. It's an incredible collection. I didn't know then what I know now, that the staff is amazing. The community is terrific. And the chance to be part of this museum at this really exciting time when everybody is coming back into person, coming out of the pandemic, it was just a really exciting moment and opportunity.
What have you been able to explore so far? What have you been most excited about?
I don't think I quite realized how astonishing the Bradley collection is. That's one thing that you walk around and you just have to say, wow. You know, one woman collected all of this. She had such a great eye. She amassed such an amazing collection, and she was so generous with it to give it to the museum and leave that legacy. So that's one of the first things that you notice when you come into the museum. There are so many wonderful pockets of collections. So the folk art or self-taught art or just art, as many people call it, collection is really deep and really amazing. There's the collection of Haitian art that is one of the best collections of Haitian art anywhere in the world. And that's here in Milwaukee. There's depths of European art, American art, especially American decorative arts. Anyway, I don't mean to sound like the museum's website, but it's pretty amazing, the strength of the collections. And I actually haven't even mentioned photography, which is the field that I come from, my first true love.
As you've explored a little bit of the pieces that are already in the Milwaukee Art Museum's collection, is there anything that's really surprised you?
Well, every day is full of surprises. So I'm trying to spend a little time every day in the galleries to really learn the collection and learn the museum. On my second day of work, I don't know how much the listeners know, but the back of house is very confusing for a new person to find their way around in. So on my second day of work, I successfully found my way to my office. I was already very excited about that. And then made my way into the galleries. And there are security measures to get in and out of the galleries that are exciting to navigate. And made my way to my favorite space in the museum, which is called the Doll Gallery. And it's got this remarkable collection of Barbara Hepworth sculptures, all in the Bradley collection, and in the most gorgeous space where you have the colors of the ever-changing lake right behind them. And it is a beautiful contemplative space. And if I were able to go into that space every day, I think I would be a very zen person.
I think I know the space you mean. It looks right over the lake, right?
Correct, yeah.
A beautiful spot to be in. It's a beautiful building. I have to imagine, though, as you say, the back of it, the back of the exhibitions must just be a labyrinth.
There are several buildings. So, you know, the museum has grown in its history with having these wonderful additions put onto it. And of course, the Calatrava building is so famous and has become such a symbol of Milwaukee. I mean, it really feels like it's adopted by everybody in the city as the mascot in a way. But there's so much more than that building, as stunning as it is. And it really, truly is stunning. So one of my goals for my time here is to get people to know what's inside the building as much as the building itself. By that, I mean the great permanent collections, but also the exciting exhibitions that we put on, and also the really creative, smart work of a huge team of dedicated staff.
That really gets to my final question. What are your major goals for the museum? What do you see as the future of the Milwaukee Art Museum?
My goals for the museum are going to be developed in concert with all of those smart, talented people who work inside that beautiful building. So this year, we're going to be really spending a lot of time thinking about some of that, in particular, thinking about how we activate the permanent collection and make it such an exciting, dynamic place to visit itself, calling attention to the art as well as to the building. I want to really make sure that we are centering the art and then aligning with the strategic direction of the museum, which is to make it relevant for the community. And that is a very exciting brief and one that gets accomplished in concert with a whole bunch of stakeholders. So not just the curators, but the designers, the outreach people, people who are on the ground working with children and families and docents, our visitor services front of house staff. So these are all, there's a huge team of people who make the museum such an exciting place to see art and experience art.
Liz Siegel is the chief curator at the Milwaukee Art Museum. We spoke back when she first started in 2023. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll help you holiday shop for the gamer in your life with a list of the top games to gift. That's tomorrow at noon right here on Lake Effect. On listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.